Good morning. I feel it is my duty as an educator of sorts to let those of you who are here this morning in on a secret that I think those of you who are not here already have figured out. Today is May the 4th, so this is Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you. I noticed suspiciously, as somebody who keeps track of the Star Wars fans in this church, that the majority of them are not here this morning. Conveniently, this is also the day that Disney has released a bunch of new Star Wars content, and I do not think that those things are unrelated. So please, look around, find your nerdy friends that aren't here, send them a quick text, and call them out for skipping church on May the 4th, because if I have to be here, everybody else does too. Just PSA. This morning we're going to look at John 21. This is, I think, most days of the week, my favorite story in the Gospels. I'm partial to this one. Maybe that's the Texan in me, because this is Jesus barbecuing, and so I like that, even if it is fish and not brisket. But this morning's reading invites us into something special. On the shore of the Sea of Galilee, sometime after the resurrection. We don't really know when. We know we've got like 40 days to work with here. Sometime in that 40 days. The disciples are still trying to make sense of everything that's happened. I would think it takes time to process your friend coming back from the dead. And in the meantime, they return to what they know. They go back to fishing. They want something that makes sense. They need something familiar. They need to participate in something that follows the rules. Yeah? And they're not good at it anymore. They fish all night and they get nothing. And it's into this moment of exhaustion, uncertainty, that Jesus shows up. Not with a grand display, but with breakfast and a simple question. Got any fish? They don't recognize him at first, but there's something about his presence, his words, and this sudden abundance of fish that reminds them who they are, of who he is. And this is a story so much more than just about fishing. If it was just a fishing story, the miraculous catch would get bigger every time, I think. But this is about how the risen Christ meets us in our ordinary lives and renews us in a call to follow him. So as we hear this story, I want you to pay attention to the ways that Jesus still meets us in our work, in our weariness, in our longing for connection, and how he calls us into community with purpose, and so much more. The word of the Lord from John 21, verses 1 through 19. Sometime after these things, Jesus shows himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, and he showed himself in this way. Gathered there together were Simon Peter, Thomas, called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples. Simon Peter said to them, "I'm going fishing." And they said, "Guess we'll go too." So they went out. They get into the boat. But that night, they caught nothing. Just after daybreak, Jesus stood on the beach, but the disciples did not know it was Jesus. And Jesus said to them, "Children, you have no fish, have you?" And they answered him, "No." Reader's commentary, I think it was probably a lot more than just a simple no. I think that they were feeling rather mocked, made fun of, small, insignificant, and their no probably matched that tone. So he said to them, "Have you tried casting your nets on the right side of the boat? Bet you'll find some." So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because there were so many fish. And now they were able to haul it in or now the disciples whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It's the Lord." That's when he figured it out, that moment. They've done this before. They've been here. They've seen this. They've participated in this. It was familiar. They went looking for the familiar, and they found it. And when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he'd taken it off. He jumped into the sea, but the other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, only about 100 yards off. When they'd gone ashore, they saw a charcoal fire there with fish on it and bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish that you've just caught." So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore, full of large fish, 153 of them. And though there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come, have breakfast." Now, none of the disciples dared to ask him, "Who are you?" Because they knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, he took the bread, gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. And this was now the third time that Jesus appeared to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" And he said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Feed my lambs." A second time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And he said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And Peter felt hurt because he had to ask him three times, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep. Very truly I tell you, when you were younger, you used to fasten your own belt and to go wherever you wanted. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will fasten a belt around you and take you where you do not wish to go." He said this to indicate the kind of death by which he would glorify God. And after this, he said to him, "Follow me." They've seen a risen Jesus twice already. This is the third time. And the story still isn't over. I've seen the movies. The movies usually end at the tomb with some kind of bright light shining, and then we cut to the credits. Not John's version. We've now had three endings, and we're still not done. Because this story never ends, right? That's intentional. That's the point. It just keeps going. These disciples have returned to something familiar. They've gone back to fishing. They've seen Jesus alive from the dead twice, and they still don't know what they're doing with their lives, and so they go back to their old ones. Maybe it's the comfort. Maybe it's the uncertainty about what comes next. Either way, they're out on the water all night. They catch nothing. These are professional fishermen. A fruitless night isn't just frustrating, it's discouraging. They've got no future they can figure with this Jesus guy who may or may not be back. Maybe they were crazy. Maybe they hallucinated the whole thing. And now they can't even do their old jobs anymore either. They're doing what they know how to do, and they still come up empty-handed. At dawn, Jesus appears on the shore to rub some salt in the wound. They don't recognize him. This is the recurring theme of the resurrection, isn't it? All these stories, Mary doesn't recognize him at the tomb. The disciples on the road to Emmaus don't know who he is. And now here, at breakfast, he's present. He's just not known. They're close to him. They know him. They're just not really aware. And even when he speaks, "Children, you have no fish, have you?" They answer with that blunt, knowing no. There's a resignation in that answer. Probably even defeat. Especially because the guy who's asking for fish already has some fish. He found some, but they couldn't. He tells them to throw the net on the other side of the boat. That had to hurt. As if they hadn't tried that all night too. You think the fish only stay on one side of the boat and they just switch sides every time they threw the nets? It's just a small little adjustment, isn't it? Just a few feet to throw it on the other side. But when they do, the net fills with fish, and then they figure it out. The recognition begins to dawn. This is their moment. Mary heard Jesus say her name, and that was her moment. The disciples on the road to Emmaus see him break bread. That's their moment. This is their moment. You'd think the first two moments were their moment, but it's this one. John says, it's him, it's the Lord. So Peter jumps in the water to go get Jesus. And this text, it captures something, I think, deeply human. We return to old routines when we don't know what to do next. We fish in familiar waters, we come up empty. And even when Jesus is near, we don't always see him for what he is. And sometimes it really does just take this blind obedience and small little things before we can recognize the very presence of Christ. And we know what it's like to fish all night and catch nothing. I don't know if any of you are fishermen by trade. I don't think you are. Or even by hobby. I don't think there's many of you out there. But most of us have metaphorically been in that boat. Not literally on a boat, but in the experience of working hard and seeing very little result. If that isn't the tune of your average day, then I don't think you belong probably in this part of the country. That tends to be the song that all of you sing, isn't it? Lots of work, little results. I've heard pretty much each and every one of you say that at some point or another, in some way, shape, or form. You pour yourself into a job, your family, your faith, your community, and yet there are just seasons when things don't come together. Despite all the work, you put in the hours, you show up, you do all the right things, and still the nets come up empty. And that leaves you exhausted. It makes you question your direction, if you've wasted your whole life. I'm not going to make anybody raise their hands for that one. We don't all need to be depressed today, but I'm pretty sure it's a large chunk of you. Sometimes, like these disciples, we return to what we know because it's easier than facing what we don't understand. Confession time. I've stopped watching new TV shows. I think that makes me old. I only, if I'm going to watch TV nowadays, watch things I've seen before. Watching a new TV show is risky, isn't it? Because what if you don't like it, and at the end of the first season, because you're going to give it a whole season to see if it gets better, and then at the end of the first season, when the credits roll, you have to acknowledge to yourself, I just wasted at least 10 hours of my life, and I'm not going to get back on this, and it was awful. If I'm going to use the very little free time that I have to watch TV at this point in my life, I want it to be a guaranteed hit. I'm going to return to something familiar. It turns out that that's actually a symptom of anxiety, in case you want to join me in this boat. People who have high anxiety are doing this more and more often now, where they are returning to only TV shows or movies that they find comforting and familiar because the anxiety builds and not knowing how it's going to turn out. That's the boat the disciples are in this story. And I think that's a boat many of us have been in before, returning to something familiar because the uncertainty of the future is just too much. Even spiritually, we feel that same futility from time to time. We go through motions, church, prayer, scripture, service. You can do those things and your heart still feels flat or disconnected. God can still feel distant. A guy like me stands up here week after week and tells you God is close and present in your lives, and you all look at me like, I don't understand the word close or present. Like the disciples, we might not always recognize Christ right in front of us because I don't think we're always looking for him. When all you want to look for are the expected things, and Christ tends to live in the unexpected things, we're not always looking. We're focused on the work, we focus on the frustration, the unanswered questions, and then there's the problem of disconnection. The world prioritizes and prizes individualism, busyness, stay in your cubicle, stay in your lane, do your thing, keep your head down. So it's easy to feel isolated. But we just weren't built to navigate life like that, alone. But many of us are certainly trying, aren't we? We've seemed to have mastered, I think, in this generation of time, the art of being alone in a crowd. We live behind our headphones or behind our screens. We can be completely alone in a crowded room. The result? Empty nets, exhausted souls, a sense of drifting. Not away from faith necessarily, but just unsure of how to move forward. Is that not what you see when you ride on the metro? That's what I see. We keep trying to fix things on our own, to manage life. We go fishing solo. And like the disciples, we often end up with nothing to show for it except for weariness and longing and maybe a sarcastic, snide no. Just when the disciples have reached the end of themselves, they are tired, they're frustrated, it's still a little dark outside, Jesus shows up. He stands on a shoreline, close enough to call out, but far enough away that they don't really see him clearly. And somehow, that's where the grace is in this story. Because he doesn't wait for them to come find him. He shows up where they are, in the middle of their ordinary, disappointing work. And I know most of you right now are cringing because that sounds like the boss dropping in at just the wrong time. But that's not what it felt like. He doesn't begin with a correction or a rebuke. He doesn't ask them why they're so bad at fishing. He just says, "Do you have no fish, do you?" It is supposed to be a gentle question. Because at least he names reality for what it is, but he's also opening the door for something much more. So he gives an invitation. Throw the nets on the other side. A simple instruction. It's almost absurdly simple. Have you tried turning it off and back on again? And they do it, and the net fills, the program runs, the work is not lost after all. It's an abundance of good things. And it opens their eyes. And John says, it has to be him. Peter, impulsive as ever, throws himself into the sea to get to Jesus. I really hope, I really hope that in the version of reality that this actually took place in, when Peter threw himself out of the boat and tried to swim to sea, that the disciples in the boat got there still before Peter, that the other disciples still beat Peter to Jesus one more time for good measure. But Peter doesn't care. He just wants to get there. The others bring the boat, they bring the net, and what do they find? A charcoal fire, bread, already cooked fish. And he says, come have breakfast. And he meets them in that moment, not with judgment, but with hospitality. He says, I know it's been a hard couple of months at work. Just take a breakfast break. And then there's this conversation with Peter. Three questions, echoing his three denials. That's got to hurt. Peter had just forgotten about that, and now we're going to bring it all back up. Do you love me? He gets asked three times. And Jesus doesn't ignore Peter's failures. He doesn't leave him in his shame either. He forces Peter through it. He restores Peter, and he commissions him, feed my sheep, take care of them. This is all resurrection grace. Jesus showing up in the middle of ordinary life, transforming failure into abundance, calling wounded people into a new purpose. And this grace Jesus extends by the sea is not just for Peter and his disciples. You don't have to deny him three times before the rooster makes noise. This is also for you. He still comes to us in the midst of our ordinary routines, our exhaustion, our confusion. He still asks us gentle, searching questions, and he still provides abundance when we have only known scarcity. And he still calls us not just to believe, to belong, to love, to serve. This is why we are refreshing and relaunching our small groups today. Because just like Peter, we need around us people to help us haul the net ashore, to race us in the boat, to fail with us. We need people to help us recognize Jesus when we've grown too tired or unsure and we just can't see it anymore. We need spaces where restoration and calling can happen, where not just on Sunday mornings, but around kitchen tables and living rooms and quiet conversations and silence. You see, small groups are not just another program. I know it feels that way. You look at your calendar every time we mention small groups and you ask yourself, when? When am I going to have time for that? And we become just another organization asking you to add something else to your calendar. I know that's how you feel about it because that's how I feel about it. But that's not what small groups are. They're not another program. They're not another thing in your calendar. The small groups that we offer here are a way to answer this invitation to come and have breakfast. It's a way for us to practice resurrection together, to feed each other, encourage each other, to challenge each other, to follow Jesus more deeply in community. And I know community can seem exhausting. I'd like to tell you a confession, confession time, secret time. I spent a lot of my time in the spring, especially at sports games, whether that's volleyball or lacrosse. I happen to know that there's a certain lacrosse player in the room whose team is currently undefeated. And when you're at these games, you all, I think, can imagine what happens. You're surrounded by other parents that you have to talk to because you sit there in silence. It's weird, so you got to talk to these other parents. And so Faith and I go to these games, and we play a game of our own from the sidelines that we like to call Parent Chicken. Do any of you know the game Parent Chicken? It's when all the parents sit around with each other and keep telling each other how perfect everything is going until one of us cracks and says, actually, we don't know what we're doing. And things are awful. And we have to play the game of Parent Chicken until somebody finally does crack. And then once somebody finally does crack and admits that they just are completely lost, everybody else joins the club. And then you get to play a new game of encouraging each other, or at least commiserating. You know this game because you play this game with your peers, yes? Someone asks you, how are you doing? And you say? What do you say? Doing fine. I'm good. And does anybody ever believe you? Do you believe people when they tell you they're doing fine? So the other day I was playing Parent Chicken, and I walked up to a parent I've been playing Parent Chicken with for a very long time, and they are a parent who seems to be a pro at Parent Chicken. And I hadn't seen them in a while, and so they said, oh, hi, and they talked about Tristan, and then they asked, how are you doing? And I said, I am at best just chugging along, just trying to go through it all and get it done. And they cracked. They finally cracked, and they said, I don't know how to do it. There's just too much to do, and I don't have enough time. You need to be in a small group so that you can stop playing chicken with each other. You need to be there. Small groups are a way for us to feed each other, encourage each other, to stop saying you're doing fine and good, and have some people to sit down with you and say, yeah, I'm absolutely miserable too. You need that. Not in a gossipy way, not in a complaining way, but in a let's help each other out kind of way. Jesus turns an ordinary morning into a holy encounter. He takes our simple gatherings and he makes them places of grace. You need that. And I know you don't always listen to me. That's fine. Sometimes I count on it because the sermon is awful and I don't want you to listen to me. So I'm bringing backup and I'm going to give you somebody that you can't say no to, because even babies listen to him. Grant, can you please come up here and talk about small groups? Grant is our newest small group ministry coordinator. I will let you all know that this is a cursed position. The last, I think, Lloyd, how many four small group ministry coordinators we've had have left and quit and moved out of state after holding the role of ministry coordinator, so good luck. But Grant has been working really hard on trying to reorganize our small groups, and not for the sake of because they need to be done, but because we've got some small groups that are on the list that don't need to be there anymore because they don't exist anymore. And we've got some small groups that are brand new, and so Grant has decided that he cares about this and wants to help us organize a little bit. And so I want Grant to tell you a little bit about his work with small groups.
I've not used this microphone before, so we'll see if this works. We have handouts that you'll be able to find that have more information on this, and I'll tell you all those are at the end. But we have several groups who are sticking around. So our young professionals, our reading circle, and our Tuesday morning women's group, they're all staying the same as they have been. But we're also starting up a few new groups. So y'all have probably heard Lloyd talking about the Gathered Singers group that's meeting after Sundays, usually about once a month, that is trying to help encourage musical literacy in the church, as well as helping us to learn and fellowship with our Spanish members. It's a bilingual group. It's our only one at the moment. Also with that, we have the group that was formerly known as Day 4 is reorganizing into Ears to Hear. And so as a group that was previously a Bible study, they're shifting their focus away. They're still going to have some Bible study, but they're going to instead be focusing on fellowship and on prayer with each other. And they plan to meet weekly. At the same time, we're starting a young families group. So we have a lot of young families with lots of little children in the church. And they have their own special needs and crazy lacrosse games and gym, yoga. I don't know what kids do. They're running everywhere, and they have no time. So they have a group that is going to be organizing, and I believe they're going to be meeting less frequently. So they're going to be meeting once formally a month and once casually a month, and I think that that's going to be a very flexible sort of thing for them to plan together and try to find a place that fits for all of them. But we have pages in the back where you can find information about each of these groups, as well as their leaders, so you can reach out to them and try to get in contact with the group. But I also want to acknowledge that these groups are not going to cover every member of the congregation. We know that there are holes, and we want to encourage, if you find a hole where you want to start a group, let us know, and we'll help try to get you the resources to be able to do that. So we know that there are parts of our congregation that are not being served properly by the groups we have. Please help us help you create that space. We've got a guide to help you get started, and that'll be a resource that we can have. As well, for our small group leaders, Chess is going to be a resource for us to utilize for that. So he is, we're going to make sure we have contact information for Chess if you need help organizing study plans or figuring out a book to study with a group, something along that line. Chess will be able to help us out. If you do want to grab one of these sheets, which I recommend, there are some on the table with all the kids' books at the back of the pews, as well as the circular table in the foyer. And for our folks in the balcony, there are a few on the corner of the banister behind the audio booth.
Thanks. You can hear a lot of things on a Sunday morning. I just want you to hear one thing, just this one thing for me, okay? I know you're busy people. I know you've got too much to do already. I'm not asking you to give anything up, and I'm not asking you to add anything to your schedule. I am asking this, to reframe how you think about small groups and what they are. If you think volunteering to lead a small group means that you have to do more work, you're wrong. You don't have to do it that way. If you think that participating in a small group is going to cost you time, I guess technically, but I don't think it's going to be a negative cost. I think you're wrong about that. You might have to work it into your schedule, yes, but let's reframe a few things. Somewhere along the way, I don't know when or why or how, somebody probably gave you the impression that in order to be part of a small group, you can't ever miss it. That you have to have perfect attendance. Have you ever felt that pressure before? And so if you can't be there all the time, might as well just not be there at all. You're going to have to let that go. And you're going to have to try casting a net on the other side of the boat. We'd love you to be there just when you can, just when you need to be. If you feel guilty for dropping in a small group and unloading all of your drama, don't. Please do that. That's a good place to do it. I'd much rather you dump your trauma and your drama in a small group here than on some unexpected stranger in line at Starbucks or in road rage. And if that means you only come to a small group once a year, that's fine too. But you need to be there. I need you to take the expectations that you have for small groups and leave them on the left side of the boat and try casting your net with small groups now on the right side of the boat and see what you get. I know for a fact that several people in this room, and I will name you if you try to hide from me, have told me in the last few months that you want a small group that does more prayer. That's what the day four group is. And I'm not saying you have to be there every single Wednesday night, but I am saying you asked for it, it's there, jump on in sometimes. If that means you're in your car driving from home and you can only be there by Zoom, that's why like half of these groups have a Zoom option, that's fine. If you don't say anything, if you just want to lurk in the background of a small group, go for it. Might be a little creepy, but we're used to that around here. It's fine. Just think about casting your net on the other side of the boat with small groups. And in the meantime, while you mull that over, remember that Jesus meets us here at this table, not with fish, but with bread and cup. After a night of confusion, after a year of hard times, 10 years, a lifetime. He meets us at this table with an unexpected morning of grace, and he says, come and have breakfast. It's not just a meal, it's restoration. You know that, right? This is not about fish and whether or not he seasoned it with Old Bay. This is about restoring people. This is about fellowship. This is about a reminder of who they are and what they're doing with their life. This table is an invitation to do the same. Not because you've got everything figured out, not because your nets are full, but because you're tired of playing chicken with everybody else in the room. Because Jesus calls you to come and eat breakfast, to be fed. And you might not even know you're hungry, but you get there and then you figure it out. This is your call to be reminded that we belong to him. It's a meal of grace here, where Christ nourishes us for the journey ahead, forgives us what is broken, sends us to feed others. As we come to this table today, I pray that we can recognize the risen Lord and the breaking of the bread, and that we can leave ready to cast nets on unexpected sides of the boat and see what amazing things happen. Let's stand and sing.